This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rodinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm J.R., a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us. We are back, Brandon Rodinghouse.
We are.
Yes, the long vacation, the hiatus is over. It's nothing but politics all the time now for us.
It seems that way, right? And you on your deathbed, right? Joined us to bring us the news.
I had a little bit of an illness, and I am back.
Lay off the eggnog.
If I sound particularly raspy, you guys are going to have to excuse me for that.
That's funny. Well, we got a bunch of stuff happening, Jay. Oddly, the politics didn't end, even though the year did. The first is that we've got an expanding field of potential candidates for president in 2020. One in particular has announced this week, Elizabeth Warren.
That's right. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, sort of the progressive leader in the Senate, has announced really the first big name to formally announce that she was going to be running for president. As you can imagine, there's a lot of conversation in and around that. She's hired away a couple of senior people from Bernie Sanders folks in 2016. She is a really interesting candidate in a lot of ways, right? She's had this ongoing back and forth with President Trump. She is incredibly gifted at taking complex ideas, particularly financial related matters, and making it simple. She's a wonderful orator, really kind of interesting kind of personality. She is a proud graduate of the University of Houston, Brandon.
Wow, there you go.
So I feel like we have to say nice things about her a little bit.
Right. But
she's an interesting candidate, a great candidate. She'll certainly be one of the top candidates.
I think the early start is going to help her. I do think that there's a sort of maybe a moment lost where now the buzz is in a slightly different direction. But I think you're exactly right that she's got a real niche here in terms of taking stands against income inequality and big banks. She talks about in her a sort of announcement about the middle class being under attack and the billionaire class essentially getting a too big of a slice of the pie. So I do think that there's an opportunity there for her to kind of talk about that narrative. There's a risk, I think, that it gets co-opted by somebody who's younger and maybe has a little bit more flash. I also think that the fact that she drinks Michelob Ultra could be a problem. Now, all these candidates have got like their own like cooking show, basically, right?
Yeah.
Beto, right? And Elizabeth Warren had a kind of preview of sort of
that's a show we should do. We should pick the beer appropriate for each person running.
Match a beer. I think that a lot of this is interesting. It's a little too soon to handicap, but I do think that she's going to join a pretty expansive field. John Delaney, former member from Maryland, Amy Klobuchar, senator from Minnesota. We're talking about Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, Julian Castro, maybe Beto. We'll see. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, too.
And, of course, there's Uncle Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. So, yeah, the field's going to be big. It's going to be we can be kind and call it multi-generational. it's going to stand from like 78 to 40. So you've got this huge sort of group of people there.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see how it goes and how it translates when you actually have the campaign.
Well, speaking of old and in with the new, we had a new year and we have a new chief of staff. Jay, what's going on there?
That's right. John Kelly is out as chief of staff. And you know how you want to judge him, Brandon? You want to judge him by all the stuff that didn't happen.
This was remarkable, right? You're referring to this interview that he gave to the Los Angeles Times upon leaving, saying exactly like you said, that the way to judge him is not the things Trump did, but the things that didn't happen. Is this not scary?
Yeah, that's a pretty low bar. We didn't have global apocalypse. The economy didn't melt down.
Success.
So I guess things were okay.
Right. Well, I think the broader implications here are really important. And we've got a new chief of staff and Mick Mulvaney, who's the OMB director. I think that Mulvaney is a bit more polished in terms of presentation. I don't know that he'll be able to rein in Trump any better than Kelly was, but I do think that he'll focus more on sort of the staff. And I think that a reboot here is probably a good thing going into a new legislative session where their White House is going to be up against a pretty serious foe in terms of the new Democratic majority. I think the bigger problem, and this, I think, is a thread that runs through all of the White House's issues, is that you've had tremendous turnover. My friend Katie Dunton Pass at Brookings did an analysis that said that 83% of senior ranking White House advisors have departed in the first 2 years. That far outpaces every other president. So this is a real problem in terms of getting their ducks in a row and getting a message out.
Yeah, look, I think there's a couple of things here. One, this makes sense in terms of moving out and bringing in Mulvaney, largely because when you're dealing with, especially in opposition in Congress, having someone who's a former member, who's generally respected by his former colleagues, is a good thing. But most importantly, and here's the problem here, it doesn't matter who the chief of staff is. James Baker could be chief of staff. The reality is that Donald Trump will not be reined in.
Right.
He will be Donald Trump. And so how do you manage Donald Trump? How do you manage that process when you have a chief executive that's unwilling to be reined in?
Yeah.
And I think that's the real challenge, regardless of who's in that office.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of reining in, the president has thrown out some pretty bombastic statements lately. He talked about closing the southern border, and this is in the context of having two immigrant children unfortunately die while they were being held. So what's your take on how this might play out? And we've talked about this before. The president can't unilaterally close the border, and doing so would cost millions of dollars and who knows how many jobs, even depending on how long it was closed. So this is just a mess. So how does the president and the White House rhetorically navigate this in the context of the big shutdown, which will be what we talk about in the deep?
Yeah, I think it's really difficult for the president here. A lot of this is coming out of the aftermath of, as you said, two immigrant children that were detained that died while in custody. It's unclear as to exactly what happened there, but this comes in the context of family separation is still an issue. The number of people coming to the border, how they're being held, is still an issue. And you've got the backdrop of the wall. You've got the shutdown as a result of the wall. So all of this is going on, and the president's view is maybe I'll just shut down the southern border, and blaming, in fact, I think Democrats for the death of the two children. So you've got a lot going on here. I think that the ultimate issue is whether or not the president really wants some sort of broader solution on immigration.
Yeah.
If he can get that, then he might be able to get some sort of physical barrier, enhanced border security, because I think everyone agrees we need more border security. But literally no one who is an expert in the subject believes that a physical concrete barrier on the southern border makes any sense whatsoever.
Right. And one of the things the outgoing chief of staff suggested was that maybe the wall is more a kind of metaphor, and the president pushed back on that, saying, no, it will actually be like a physical thing. So I don't know that this can be something that they can maneuver the president off of, but the president is not just facing a controversy from within his own White House or from within the chamber that's opposing him, but also from within his own party. It turns out Mitt Romney is back as a potential foe of the president, and although they had made nice temporarily, it is now the case that the gauntlet has been thrown by Mitt Romney, who's the newly elected senator from Utah.
Yeah, so Mitt Romney had written a pretty scathing op-ed in the Washington Post that has since been picked up by many other newspapers, where he essentially says that the president sort of lacks the character.
Yeah.
For that office.
Has not risen to the mantle of the office.
Right. Essentially, the notion that the presidency itself carries with it a responsibility and requirement of weight that you have to lead by example. The president essentially not doing that. The real question to me is this, Brandon, is this sort of John McCain 2.0,
mm-hmm.
or is this Jeff Flake 2.0?
Right.
The difference being one guy really took it to the president, voting against the president on key issues. The other guy was rhetorically argumentative, but essentially voted with the president when it really came down to it.
Well, when asked if he'd support the border wall, Mitt Romney said he would. So it's not a sticking point in terms of policy. I think that they're likely to see a lot of agreement. I think it's more about the tone of the office. Now, Mitt Romney's traditionally been a pretty nice guy, even during the election in 2012. This is about as mean as he gets, right? Although, remember, during the 2016 election, he delivered a fairly scathing rebuke of Trump, saying that he was a phony and a bully, and criticized some of the more inflammatory rhetoric about Muslims and Mexican immigrants. So I suspect that we will see Romney push back on Trump's tone, but maybe not so much on policy. So I think the hope of having Romney as McCain is probably too much of a stretch. But I do think that you're going to see Romney potentially push back on things like separation of powers and the kind of dynamics of the two institutions. And that's really what I think a lot of Republicans would join him with. In terms of policy, they're going to agree generally. But I do think that in terms of that institutional difference is where you're going to see Romney chime.
Well, this wasn't the only inter-party squabble that was going on. Outgoing Senator Claire McCaskill from Missouri got into it, where she was quoted essentially saying that she doesn't understand why everyone is making such a big deal about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the new congresswoman from the Bronx.
That's right. I think partly it's because she has her own like Instagram account, and she does all kinds of fun stuff like, you know, cooking, and she has all kinds of interactions with people on there. This is a new generation in terms of how these members are interacting with the rest of the world, and McCaskill called her the new shiny object. So it was seemingly an insult, but I think that this is more meaningful maybe than just this kind of, you know, tete-a-tete in terms of name calling, because you've got this progressive wing of the Democratic Party who wants to take a serious stand. And this is the week that they're being, you know, sworn into office, and things are going to get kicked off. And it's likely to get kicked off with a little inter-party skirmish within the Democratic Party in terms of rules and in terms of how to organize the fiscal sort of health of the legislation going forward. So this is something which I think is not just about old versus new. This is a serious inter-party ideological battle.
Well, I also think, in fairness to McCaskill, I think her point was more that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she won in a primary.
Yeah.
Of the 41 new members of the House, over 30 of them won in essentially flipping traditionally red districts. Her Ocasio-Cortez's district is like 81% minority and overwhelmingly Democratic. Their only real question is what took them so long to elect her versus the incumbent Joe Crowley. So I think it's more about what's the big deal about her and the fact that she's become this media darling than I think anything more than that.
Right. I gotcha. So there's a lot that happened, of course, politically, but a lot of these things connected to some of the financial health of our country. Jay, I don't know if you noticed, but while you were feasting on turkey and ham and enjoying some nice Bordeaux, your 401k basically dried up. So the stock market is down significantly this year. The Dow is down 5%, S&P 500 down 6%. This is a potential liability for the president. What's your read on kind of the economic status of the country?
Yeah, the volatility in the market, because it's been doing sort of this zigzag. It had been on a relatively upper trajectory for most of 2018, and the month of December just collapsed, losing massive, basically the entire year's worth of value. If you had invested at the beginning of the year and you were considerably ahead buying all those Christmas presents, you're now in big trouble because you lost all that money in a span of 3 weeks. I think the issue is kind of for the president, sort of the macro economy.
Yes.
While you still see some level of growth, almost 3% annually now, or quarter to quarter, what you're not seeing is a shrinking in the deficit. The report came out that the deficit is still expanding even at a time of economic prosperity. The other element is this uncertainty around trade. You've got problems in terms of trade with Europe. You've still got steel tariffs. We're seeing the ramifications of the agricultural tariffs on China. Soybean sales in particular have just collapsed. You've got silos full of garbanzo beans.
Yeah, that sounds great.
I know it does, actually. It's a lot of hummus.
That's a lot of
hummus out there. You've got all of this uncertainty going on. You've got volatility in the Middle East in terms of gas prices. So all of this is going on at a time when you're dealing with the economy. The market is starting to show that volatility. I'm not sure what it means. We've had almost 10 years of unprecedented growth.
Mm-hmm.
We're essentially due for a recession. So I think there's a certain economic argument that 2019 does not bode well for the state of the U.S. economy.
I think it's a real liability, too, for the president politically. There is a threshold of economic success where his suburban coalition won't abandon the Republican Party or him. That may be the year where that gets passed, and that could be serious problems for him and for Republicans up and down the ballot. Remember, the signature win for the Trump White House was going to be the tax plan, right? It was going to put more money in people's pockets, but that has essentially all been, you know, flittered away. So this is, I think, a real issue. For context, generally speaking, presidents are reelected if the real income growth is between 2 and 3% or higher. In the middle of that 2 and 3% or lower, it becomes a little more dicey. So we'll see if that holds up. But as it is now, wage growth is slightly up under President Trump, but inflation is also up. So the real question is whether or not people are feeling the economic effects. And if they don't, or if it goes south, then it could be a real problem for the president's reelection.
Well, Brandon, let's talk a little Texas politics now. We had all our county officers across the state of Texas get sworn in just a couple days ago in January 1. We got a legislature in session. They're all going to be sworn in the next day or two. So we got a lot going on, but big changes in most of our urban counties, particularly in Harris County and Fort Bend County, where you had essentially two counties that were red flip and become solidly blue.
That's right. And you've got two new judges, county judges, in each of those cases. Both of them are inexperienced politically. Both of them are immigrants, which is really interesting, right? KP George in Fort Bend County and Lita Hidalgo in Harris County. So do you think that the kind of reaction to the election of these sort of political newcomers has been overblown? Or do you think that there's real sort of cause to worry because these are obviously big, booming economies? You've got a tremendous number of people who are sort of relying on the city and the county infrastructure to make sure things are running on time, and the ever-present prospect of giant wind and rain-related events that could potentially be a difficult scenario. So what's your take on how worried that the region should be?
Well, look, I think it's a little premature for anyone to draw any conclusions about how they're going to do in office. The couple of things to remember: the county judge position itself doesn't really have that much in terms of institutional authority. It's really a position that essentially you're the presiding officer of a commissioner's court. Those individual commissioners really do most of the sort of day-to-day within those geographic areas. The big thing is kind of the tone they set and the larger policy direction they want to take the counties in. That's really, I think, how they're going to be judged, how they lead their counties in terms of the things they want to focus on. You've got, I think, really good, capable people around them, but I don't think there's any cause for anyone to panic. I don't think there's going to be any problems happening anytime soon, even in the area of disaster management. But how they lead in terms of on those issues, flood control, how they lead on sort of large public policy issues and the agenda they set, I think is how they're going to be judged.
Yeah. There's also a bunch of new judges coming in. In fact, Harris County has a record number of black female judges, 17 coming in, all sworn in this year. There's also the first openly gay female elected to the legislature, who's going to be sworn in next week when the ledge gets into session. So the sort of political scene is getting much more diverse, and
that's right.
Partly,
I mean,
because the party's pushing that, right?
Right, right. We have a new Texas. I mean, Ann Richards talked about that all those years ago. Yeah. It's really kind of coming home. Texas and this area, the greater Houston area, is one of the most diverse areas in the country, if not the most diverse area in the country. And it's really reflected now in the leadership that we have.
Yeah. And well, this is also something that some candidates for president potentially are looking for. Julian Castro is flirting pretty seriously with the prospect of running for president. Jay, he had a bunch of reporters over to his house and he announced that he was looking into it. And there's rumors he's going to announce more formally sometime soon as to not get too far behind people like Elizabeth Warren. So what do you think is going to happen here, especially if it's the case that, say, potentially Beto O'Rourke jumps into the race as well?
Yeah, Julian v. Beto. That's right.
How does
Texas
that primary
showdown
work out, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll be interesting. I mean, Julian, I think, is definitely in. His brother, Joaquin Castro, congressman from San Antonio, basically said Julian's going to run.
Yeah.
I don't see why he wouldn't run. I think you're going to have about 15, 20 candidates. The challenge right now for Castro is he's really in that second or third tier of candidates that have been mentioned. He doesn't have anywhere near the national name ID. The upside is the way the calendaring itself has changed. We now have a true Super Tuesday. California and Texas are both March 3rd primaries. Mm-hmm. Just really a week or two following what we see in New Hampshire and South Carolina. So I think there's an opportunity here. Democrats want to fall in love with their presidential candidate, and Republicans fall in line with their presidential candidate. My sense is that Beto, I think, has the clear advantage here, but he's also going to be taking all the slings and arrows. No one's mentioning Julian Castro, so it might actually work to his benefit if everyone is focusing on O'Rourke and he falters or doesn't meet expectations. You've got someone there capable of taking the mantle on.
Yeah, I mean, there's a definite different sort of mindset and structure for how to run for president than how to run for Senate. That said, he's electric, right? O'Rourke has really got that energy. And that's something that at least early on can be really successful. But look, we're talking about this being, you know, upwards of a, you know, year plus away in terms of the first primary. So there's a real danger in peaking too early.
But let's remember the first debates are within 6 months.
Yeah.
I mean, this 2019 is the staging ground. It's the real campaign for these early 3-4 primaries because you're going right into it after that. So it will certainly be interesting. We've got a legislative session, Brandon, and I'll tell you what, school finance, the number one issue, the Texas School Public Finance Commission that was set up by the governor laid out a plan, and it's getting positive reviews from Republicans, but also from Democrats.
Yeah, that's what's absolutely needed, right? I mean, this isn't going to work unless you've got energy on both sides pushing for it, right? One sort of sticking point, though, Jay, is how much money that the state should kick in, right? And so early drafts of the report suggested that the state ought to kick in more money, and then subsequent drafts sort of removed that language or took out the actual number. So there could still be some sticking points, but there are some very specific things that are noted here, I think, that you could get some consensus on, like encouraging teacher evaluation metrics and tie that to performance pay, more money for dual language programs, more money for low-income students in districts that have a higher share of needy students. So there are some particular opportunities here, I think, that could be within striking distance, right? If the governor prioritizes it as we expect him to, and you've got a new speaker who is really, you know, driven to make this change, I think you're likely to see some movement. The one sticking point here is potentially Dan Patrick in the Senate, right, who has a different view of public education, perhaps, than the rest of his Republican colleagues. So we'll see the degree to which there's some compromise here, but I do think we're going to see some movement.
No, I do too. I mean, the question is sort of structurally from a bill perspective, do they try to do sort of this large kind of omnibus bill, or are they going to be doing a series of things? I think pre-K for all is certainly something that the governor has been very high on,
right,
and Speaker Bonin himself has talked about wanting to do that. I think you're probably going to see a supplement of around anywhere between $1.5 to $2 billion in public education, which will essentially put us back to where we were in 2011 before they did the structural cuts. I think the other side of it is the governor's plan of really dialing down and capping property taxes to allowing essentially only 2.5% growth. That's going to place down line create some real problems for some of these school districts.
I mean, can you do both? If you're injecting that much money into the school system, can you still have property taxes capped at that point? I mean, it's going to require more than, you know, the $2 billion to kick in to from
the cap, I think, is a move forward process. So you're not going to ratchet it down, but you're essentially going to stop the growth. And his idea is that by limiting growth, you essentially force state government to pay more. It's interesting that the governor's proposing it. I'll be curious to see how they do it, because going forward, without the funding mechanisms in place, they're going to have to cut from other areas to supplement to make up that difference.
It's real tricky. And there's already a huge, like, $8 billion hole that they've got to fill in terms of the priorities. So this is going to be, I think, a real kind of conundrum. I think everyone has an appetite to feast at the buffet, but then at the end of it, you're going to have a bellyache and a big bill. And I don't know that they're willing to do that. So we'll see how far they get.
So, Brandon, we got the session starting.
Yes.
And what do we expect? I mean, we talked about school finance. That's certainly going to be high on the agenda, if not number one. We know they have to do a budget by law. We'll get a new biennium budget. But what else is out there that you think we might see some movement on?
You know, I think the biggest sticking point is going to be the kind of religious liberty issues that the nation has faced and that has been driven in part by some of the stuff happening in Texas. The Supreme Court ruled on a case from Colorado, which tepidly allowed for states to allow for individuals to not take particular kinds of work or engage in certain kind of industry or business with people they didn't share their religious beliefs. A bill that didn't pass that is likely to show up again, in part because it was co-authored by one now speaker, Dennis Bonin, would allow individuals and businesses and other entities to refuse service to same-sex couples based upon their religious beliefs. So I think this is going to be the biggest sticking point. This will be the new bathroom bill.
I agree with you 100% on that. The other one to me is, I think medical marijuana legalization will probably happen this session.
Yeah.
You've got real bipartisan support for it, at least on the medical side.
Yeah.
State Senator Jose Menendez just filed a bill essentially allowing for the legalization of medical marijuana. What I think is interesting is every state around Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas, have now legalized medical marijuana. And so you're creating a mechanism, at least a better argument, so that Texas is not alone in this.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, Jay, the biggest sort of news of the week is the continuing shutdown. So this is going to be obviously something we're going to deal with, not just sort of this week, but probably also next week and for who knows how long. So what's your take on exactly what the politics of this are going to shake out to be? Who's in the right? The president says Democrats are to blame. Democrats say White House is to blame. But let's cut through it and figure out what exactly is going on.
Well, I think we need to unpack a couple of things. It's really a relatively small percentage of the budget that's at play, and because they had prior deals in place. The issue largely is one singular item. The president wants about $5 billion for a barrier, concrete and steel barrier, along the southern border of the United States. The Democrats essentially wanted to, at one point, wanted to give him about half that amount and have scaled it back to about $1.5 billion of that $5 billion. You have many Democrats who say don't give him any.
Right.
Beto O'Rourke, congressman, former congressman from El Paso now, has talked about this. It put out a video basically saying it's physically almost impossible to build this wall along the southern Texas border because we've got so many natural borders. It essentially destroys the Rio Grande River.
Yeah.
From a policy argument, the wall itself makes no sense if you talk to anyone around it. What I don't understand, and we talked a little bit about this before, other Republicans have argued all we're really talking about is sort of security enhancements along the border, smart fencing, technology, a sort of technological barrier, which I think both sides would agree on. But the president keeps talking about a physical barrier, Brandon.
Yeah, and you know, there have been offers to essentially try to give some money for this, or you know, for more money for border security more generally. And the vice president apparently is negotiating with Chuck Schumer. That has not gone anywhere. Like a lead balloon, the president has said, I can't take that. It's basically to make me look foolish if I did. I think he's probably right, but this is why you need a communication shop that helps you to sort of organize this beforehand, because the negotiating position essentially has been eroded, right? He said in a tweet and in a meeting with the Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer that he'd be happy to own it, the shutdown that is, and the public agrees. Polling released this week said 42% say Trump was to blame. Only 22% say that Democrats are to blame. I think the real issue here is that 44% of independent voters say that both parties are equally at fault. So it looks like Washington can't get anything done. Like you say, this is only part of a government shutdown, so it's not the whole thing, but that's to come too. And the fact that the government can't get their act together here, I think, is a real problem for incumbents potentially in 2020, but especially for Republican incumbents. But the president's tactics here may work. I don't know. And what's your take on sort of how this is going to end? What's the solution for both parties that's agreement?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what the actual solution is going to be here, because the normal thing would be for the president to essentially get something and then declare a victory. But what it seems to me what's happened is that President Trump has effectively argued that anything less than a physical concrete barrier is a defeat. Because I think the offer that for a sort of a technology wall, some sort of enhanced fencing, very similar to what you see in other countries, you would have thought would have satisfied him and others that think that's a good idea. But he seems to be sort of opposed to that. So I don't know what the actual solution is, because now you have Democrats, on the particularly the more progressive ones, saying no wall whatsoever, nothing at all.
Yeah, and I think that this is puts like Nancy Pelosi in a pretty tough spot, right? Because she has to manage this coalition the same way that President Trump does. I think that the White House's tactics are getting sharper. They're talking more about the wall for, you know, limiting drug shipments and limiting human trafficking.
Except the problem with that is the data doesn't support it, because because 90%+ the DEA's own data says it's all coming from air and water. None of it's coming illegally across the border like this. And so it doesn't make any sense from a public policy perspective.
No, I know. But I mean, I think that this is, at least from a rhetorical perspective, the president's trying to gain that leverage and talking about the kind of crisis at the border is maybe not getting the kind of traction it used to. So I think they have to switch tactics. And I'm like you, I don't know exactly what they could say or do to reach some compromise. It seems to me there's a lot of room here for it, but the president doesn't seem willing to do so. But we'll see if the new year has him, you know, thinking about, you know, kind of new opportunities, right? Just like all of us, Jay.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, a big thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the Shutdown Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Roddinghouse. We'll see you next week.